Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Phantom Galaxy Podcast. This is our first ever episode. My name is Nathan Bartlebaugh. I've previously done podcasting with Nathan Bell over on Pop Culture Ninja. We're doing something a little bit different tonight, starting a podcast that's dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, horror, and what we've been kind of discussing is speculative fiction. And I'm joined with Chris Durham.
Hi, I'm a friend of Nathan's. We've hung out quite a bit over the course of our life and watched many, many movies together.
Not always good.
Especially not always good, yes. That made it even better somehow. The worse the movie, the better the time. But I've been interested in horror for a good portion of my life, so thought it'd be cool to kind of get together and talk about it. Also love anything sci-fi fantasy related.
That's right, and you've also been on Pop Culture Ninja a few episodes,
yeah, that's right.
And we also have my sister, Rachel Bartlebaugh, with us tonight.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, Rachel.
And we are, tonight, we're going to just kind of have an introductory episode we're going to discuss. It's funny because when we originally started this, we were talking about speculative fiction being a bit of a catch-all term, but we're going to talk about that a little bit tonight, talk about kind of just to break the ice and talk about what in the genre kind of started our fascination with it. You know, starting back from childhood, there's certain things I can remember, books and movies and things like that, that I was kind of engaged in. Just talk about sort of our favorite things in the genre. We're going to talk about that for a little bit. Is there a thing that you can remember that drew you to the genre? Rachel, you want to go first?
Obviously, growing up with Nathan, I was exposed to a lot of books. He would read me a lot of stories, or I would have books handed down from that he would read. I think of like John Bellairs and Ray Bradbury, even like Chronicles of Narnia and books like that. It was probably where I would say it started, but definitely watching movies like Spielberg movies growing up, a lot of things on TV.
It.
Oh, yeah. The ripe age of
oh, that's
four.
Brutal.
Was it four? Really?
Yes, because it was
I'm
six
sorry.
By the time I saw Candyman.
You were raised right.
Yeah, so obviously I saw a lot of stuff thanks to having older brothers, and I feel like it was somewhat inherited. But
that may explain why you had, what was the boogeyman that you had growing up? The man who keeps the kids awake?
Yeah.
In a very utilitarian title.
Yeah, and where most people have like imaginary friends are like bears or stuff like that, I had three skeletons, one of which was named Skeletor. Not like I watched He-Man enough times or anything. Yeah, pretty twisted little
fantastic.
Head.
Fantastic.
Nice. Chris, how about you?
Well, I had a somewhat different growing up, actually, a little bit more conservative, and I never really liked scarier stuff growing up, so I didn't really get into horror until I was a little older, probably 13, 14. But the first real fantasy I got into would have been probably the Chronicles of Narnia, starting off with that, and then I kind of just leaped into Lord of the Rings from a tender age, probably 10 or so.
It's a good age to get started.
Yeah, and I started at the library in the worst possible place. They didn't have a copy of Fellowship of the Rings, so I started at the Two Towers, and I fell in love with the book instantly, although I had no clue what had just happened, the first book.
I don't even know what a Shire is.
Exactly.
It's a hobbit.
So, right. Then I did get a copy of the Fellowship of the Ring, and
it's probably pretty anticlimactic at that point.
It was, because I was ready for that last chapter by that point, but I had to read the beginning. So I got the book out, and my mom promptly told me, "Wait a minute, is that a wizard on the cover? You're not supposed to read that."
So, nice.
Beware the wizards.
But I did sneak a read of that book and finished up the series, and really fell into love of all kinds of fantasy stuff. I mean, I love Star Wars and Star Trek growing up, you know, like everybody else. Like I said, a little older on, I would sneak horror movies at a friend of mine's house. And the first one that I really remember watching and being like, you know what, this scary experience is actually kind of entertaining, seeing this other side of things, was The Relic. You remember that?
We do. We like The Relic. Yeah,
The Relic,
Rachel.
I hate horror movies. I like The Relic.
I remember reading the novel first before the movie, and that was very creepy in and of itself.
Yeah.
The book is really creepy. But the movie was a fun kind of cheesoid.
A bit of a romp.
I remember seeing the theater, and there's a great scene where the monster catches on fire and sort of chases Penelope Ann Miller down a hallway or something.
That's actually a fun time. Awesome way to come in contact with Tolkien, though. Like, my first exposure to Tolkien was the old cartoon, The Hobbit, and it's like,
The Rankin Bass.
The nine
wow.
Every frame skips.
Yes, it was still awesome. I still like it.
I will say that as far as the Hobbit cartoon goes, I kind of prefer the Hobbit cartoon to the 12 hours of
bloated
of
mess.
Peter Jackson's Hobbit story. Yeah,
Remember the 80s, like McDonald's toys where you could put like Ronald McDonald hair on all the different like characters? I always used to think that that was the hair that Frodo had.
It kind of does. Orson Bean was the voice, I think, of was it Roddy McDowell was Samwise? Because we just recently rented and watched it with the kids. And then I love John Huston's Gandalf voice. Because I felt like up until we got Ian McKellen, who's now the definitive Gandalf, like I was like, who's going to beat the John Huston Gandalf voice?
Definitely, I feel like Peter Jackson could have used a little, looked at the old Hobbit cartoon and realized, you know what, I can rein some of this in. I really
a little
don't have to film.
Judicious cutting.
Yeah, I don't have to film every single sentence in the book.
Well, not even that. I don't have to add three extra books of my own nonsense. Yeah. Yes.
Hobbit was always a melding for me. Or The Lord of the Rings, the cartoon one, was like a melding for me. Because our grandmother, or maybe it was our grandfather, used to tell us a scary story about like a giant frog. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
And so that's also probably a little bit why I like a lot of what I guess you could term speculative fiction. We had a lot of stories told us, like folk tales and stuff growing up.
Which is going to be a part of this podcast,
which was cool,
too. Yeah.
Really?
But
fantastic.
Gollum in that reminded me, I always thought it was a frog monster.
The way they drew him, and that's the one that was like voiced by Brother Theodore, so he had this deep, he was like kind of croaky kind of sound. He did sort of
I thought
like
it was the frog. I was like, it was
And I remember later when Brother Theodore showed up in The Burbs. He was the older grandpa.
Now there's a classic.
I don't understand. It was parked outside all day.
I love that movie.
His voice too is in The Last Unicorn, where he was Angela Lansbury's henchman in that. Mommy Fortuna.
Now you lost me.
Oh, The Last Unicorn. Well, you know what? You can catch up, because I think on Amazon Prime or on Netflix, Last Unicorn. Watch it.
It's a children's film.
But it has a soundtrack by America. How can you go wrong?
You know what? You've changed my opinion.
There you go. Check it out. We could sing. Rachel, I could probably sing the theme song right now.
Now you really want to lull me to sleep.
Yes, that's right. And everyone else with you. I think my first real memory of something that caught my attention was relatively young. It was the original 1933 King Kong. Because I remember sitting on my dad's lap in the house watching. I remember the scene where he broke the Tyrannosaur's jaw. Another movie that Peter Jackson felt he couldn't improve on by adding not one but three Tyrannosaurs and about an hour and a half of additional material. But that was kind of the start. But I think that what was compelling about those things, and what's compelling about those things as a kid, or at least to me, was that sense of artificiality. Like, I couldn't see it anywhere else. To me, movies like that were like an extension of running around the house playing pretend or playing games with your imagination. So and storytelling too, like Rachel said, or people around their house told a lot of stories. Mm-hmm. Stories that were clearly stories, not lies, but stories embellished, and it was fun to see how far you could embellish. And I remember our grandfather kind of sitting down next to that old wood stove telling ghost stories and things like that.
How come you got King Kong and I got It?
It was just a different time.
I was the youngest of
four. I was very young, though.
Caring.
King Kong was at age like two or three, though. So I'm talking very young. Like, I was probably between my kids' age, Johnny or Izzy at that time when I saw King Kong. Because, I mean, I saw Aliens around like six, so.
So I don't remember seeing King Kong till I was an adult, but it was definitely around the 40s.
Yeah, The Howling was around that time, early.
When was Brain Dead? I remember you saw that fairly
Rachel young. Saw Brain Dead, which is Peter Jackson again. We can't get away from the ghost of Peter Jackson. That was Dead Alive.
Everything turns back to Peter Jackson.
Yes, yeah. It's like the six alive. Degrees of Peter Jackson. Dead Alive, I saw that when I was in high school, the first year of high school. So that would have been ninth grade for me. So I was probably like 13 or something. That makes you what?
I'm 5 years younger, so I would have been
8.
Yeah.
Not a bad age. But you know what? That was a weird. That was, I remember watching. That was like New Year's Eve or something.
Yeah, but that movie wasn't scary.
It was just, you felt weird and delirious after watching it, not really freaked out. You were sort of like, what did I just see?
The scene that bothered me was the pus scene at the table. And that's just because it grossed me out.
The pus and the porridge. Best custard I've ever eaten. So, when we were talking before, and we got into the term of speculative fiction. Now, was that something that you guys are really been aware of as a terminology? I've heard it kicked around a lot. I've even seen people kind of categorize that, you know, back in the day when I was in the library and stuff, and you'd see SF as a tag on the books, and I was like, okay, that's science fiction. And I think in most cases it is, but I've also heard people say, well, okay, well, we're going to categorize this whole thing as SF, as speculative fiction.
Sorry, I heard of it very briefly in one of my literature classes in school. Like, it was modern literature. And the term, it was not like an actual like term that we studied, but it was a term that was mentioned and thrown about. But that was it. I hadn't heard of it in a couple of years until you brought it forward.
Yeah, it's a term that I just recently came back across. You know, I mean, it's something I've always been kind of aware of. But when trying to think of how to categorize the podcast, it's like, you know, saying science fiction, fantasy, and horror all the time. Mm-hmm. It captures a certain grouping of things because though all those three genres, I think they're very much intertwined in a lot of ways. And some of the really good mm-hmm. stories are elements of all those things.
Yes.
I feel like some of the stuff we've already mentioned in our brief amount of time talking here in these few minutes have those elements intertwined. Lord of the Rings is fantasy, yes, but there's some dark fantasy in there. There's some horrific moments. Like the encounter with Shelob is something straight out of a horror story.
Giant spider in the dark.
The giant spider, Gollum, the orcs, the way the orcs are described, the race through the mines of Moria. Those have very much horror elements in them. And I mean, just recently, Pop Culture Ninja, we did an episode talking about utopias, which are largely science fictional ideas. But we did discuss how, in a sense, Tolkien was getting at utopian ideas through some of the different realms and the different worlds, because he wrote those stories as if they were history. And so writing them as history, you had the past, and then it kind of moved forward to the future and the gray havens and everything. So I feel like there's a lot of meshing of genres there.
I've always appreciated C.S. Lewis's approach to making things darker in his books, because he'd always say, "In the clearing, they saw these witches and hags and other things that I would write down, but if you did, your parents wouldn't let you read this book." You know, it's just a fantastic description.
The difference, right? It was like he would spend more time describing what the dirt that the trees ate tasted like.
Yes.
You could tell it's like... Lewis and Tolkien, sometimes I felt like they wrote some of their chapters right before lunchtime, because like Tolkien just wrote five breakfasts in like one chapter, but then the Mines of Moria is Helm's Deep is really like four paragraphs. It's like, but then there's like a whole thing about sausages that like hobbits eat. But I think the difference there being that Lewis was more like telling like a fairy tale, and Tolkien approached his almost like a history with all the linguistic elements, which is where he was coming from, being a linguist. But I guess I feel like some of the really good stuff has combinations of all of those. And when I was growing up, the books I read, Lord of the Rings and some of these other stories, Rachel mentioned John Bolaris, and I feel like that's a guy who no one talks about anymore. But he wrote some really cool, gothic, kids' horror stories. Mm-hmm. Like, I'd say they were, if you were looking for a kind of feel, they were one occult step up from, like, the Hardy Boys or something like that. But it's where the Hardy Boys would always encounter something and always turn out to be something mundane. In the John Blair's books, it really always was warlocks or robots that wanted to steal your eyes. He wrote books like Eyes of the Killer Robot, The Mummy, The Will in the Crypt, The House with a Clock in its Walls.
Now, this guy sounds fascinating, but I haven't read any of his material. The closest thing I could approximate is the Frank Peretti series of like young adult novels where they would go finding like the doorway to hell and things like that, and they'd have to find ways to stop it from opening. And
I suspect that quality-wise, there's a huge gap.
Probably.
I couldn't prove this, but I feel like Belair's was a large inspiration on J.K. Rowling, if I had to guess.
Definitely.
You know, we talk about how Rowling maybe was influenced by people like, again, they think of Tolkien and Lewis when they think of the British fantasy authors, but someone like John Bolaris, I suspect that there's a lot of... I think that Rowling had to at least be aware of Bolaris.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's a lot of his element, a lot of benign wizards and witches fighting dark wizards and witches that often were off stage because their powers had been sapped and they were trying to find their way back into this world, and they did so through, like, youthful... Mm-hmm. And Belairs would write series, so he would follow several different young antagonists who were often friends. The neighbor was the witch or the warlock that helped them out. So there wasn't a
Lewis
school involved. Lewis Barnevelt was the House of Clock and Walls. Johnny Dixon was Eyes of the Killer Robot. And there was another one from the Alpheus Winterbourne, but I don't remember like the character there. So I think all those genres tend to sometimes be intertwined, although they are, when you go to the library, it wasn't until later that I would go to the library and realize, oh wait, there's a specific place for science fiction. There's a specific place for fantasy, and a lot of the books are very popular in that are very much written down the line. You know, they're written towards a certain kind of niche science fiction or niche fantasy. Some of the really good stuff tends to straddle those genres. Horror is something, too, that like is almost ghettoized a little bit. Like, I feel like horror doesn't quite get its due all the time. It tends to be one of those genres that people, at least back in the day, I think, looked down upon a little bit. Mm-hmm. Horror is more, I think Chris and I, you were talking, we kind of described it as like maybe a more lurid genre. There's a lot of garbage that pops up in the horror genre. Particularly, horror lends itself well to movies. And I mean, that's probably where we've seen most of our horror. I've read a lot of horror, but I've seen more horror in films, I think.
There is a lot of good horror, but at the same time, it's there is a wasteland of like just trash out there, you know, like... I think more so than other genres, for sure. But if you're willing to wade through it, you can find some really great stuff.
It runs a gamut, because I am not a... I would not... I don't know. I wouldn't say that I'm a fan of horror, but I also wouldn't say that I hate it, because it depends on what spectrum, what end of the spectrum you're on. Like, Saw and stuff like that, I would just call garbage. But then I have a real appreciation for probably stuff that stems more out of a folk style of telling. I enjoy like ghost stories. I enjoy certain creature stories. Like, I enjoyed Relic. One of my favorite movies is actually The Others. That to me was a fantastic. That to me is an epitome of a great like horror movie.
Hitchcockian horror movie.
Yes, yeah. And yeah.
Henry James, A Turn of the Screw, which is sort of The Others is.
Oh, that was great too.
The Innocents is an excellent horror movie. Yeah. Jack Clayton. Yeah, so they run the gamut, and something like horror is so disparate in the fact that it's the same genre that has Sleepaway Camp and Turn of the Screw and Most Dangerous Game and those kinds of stories that all have those elements. Speculative fiction seems like an easy catch-all. Like, oh, I enjoy speculative fiction. And as funny, Rachel was like jokingly defining it earlier. Speculative fiction, it's fiction that speculates. Something I was reading specifically is points out that speculative fiction is really the what if. And that's what I always thought of it as. It's like, if a writer sits down and thinks, what if? And of course, what if precludes that this is the way things are. So what if is a greater catch-all.
Reality can be what you want it to be.
Reality can be bent a little bit. So I think it's also useful because it catches genres or books or stories that don't fall into an easy genre. And I thought they were some great examples I found online. At one point, a story like Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan stories kind of fall in that, because Tarzan, I would typically kind of keystone as an adventure story, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, but I can see that being very speculative. What if a man really was raised by apes? And not just apes, but these apes that sort of have their own culture and their own world and everything like that. And Jaws, too, being an example of maybe more speculative. Because Jaws doesn't fit easily, I think, most people will categorize as horror. But I think if you really look at that movie as a whole, it's not a horror movie. Not all of it. Chris, what do you think?
I agree completely. Yeah.
It's like, it's got horror elements, but there's a lot of like Ernest Hemingway almost hunting the animal sort of feel to the story. But there's this idea, the shark is larger than most sharks. We haven't but we've never seen a shark this big kill this many people in this fashion. So that's not to say that anytime you just think of something that hasn't quite happened, that's speculative. But I think it's something to do with the world. The whole feel of the world to Jaws and Tarzan, to me, lend themselves to a what if. That Peter Benchley sits down and thinks, what if, in this scenario? Or Edgar Rice Burroughs thinking, what if? Mm-hmm. What I like about that concept of what if is that's what's drawn me to those genres. I really like, particularly in fiction, whether it's movies or games or books or TV shows or comic books. And all those are the sorts of things we want to talk about in this show. We don't want to really limit it to any one thing. And we want to bounce back and forth between fantasy and sci-fi and horror and even some of those bits that fall down the middle. I guess that's what's really drawn me to it, the idea that it's thinking beyond the box. And I think the genre is at the best.
And you get so much of thinking in the box in your daily life. I mean, just all the time you're sitting in your cubicle and you're like, okay, I've got to do these things or whatever. And it's just you need some sort of outlet to be able to think outside the box. Mm-hmm. So I find that speculative fiction is an enjoyable way to kind of let your mind free a little bit. Think, well, what could happen if I'm in this fantasy world, you know, fighting orcs? It's pretty cool.
That's true. I think what I like too about the speculative fiction angle is sometimes people, I think, who are outside the genre, who just watch from the outside in, that they think, you know, it can be kind of a mindless genre. Oh, you've got superheroes, or you've got, you know, fantasy, and that's all hacking, slashing. But, like, speculative fiction just suggests a good deal of thought and imagination goes into something. And I think that that's true of all three of those genres. I think fantasy it can be boilerplate and cut and paste, but there can be fantasy with a lot of thought put into it.
Even though it's gotten watered down a little bit, just a dystopian, utopian type literature, it's that sort of just thinking about where the world's headed, where our society's headed, what could lead to these potential things, or, you know, if these patterns keep going, where could, you know, I think for me, it's definitely a thinking style of literature or media, I guess.
It's a way to lift the mirror up without, like, casting such a stark glance that you just sort of get either distracted or depressed or sort of put off by it. You know, I think that sometimes those writers can bring up topics that we struggle with in such a way that's compelling without it being a major, like, stumbling block. So, some of your favorites. We talked about things we like growing up, but, like, favorites in the genre, anything that really you think, whether you like it or not, maybe that typifies a specific aspect of some of these genres, like science fiction or fantasy. In my mind, Chris, you were talking about horror and stuff like The Relic, and I did always really enjoy, like, monster stories and monster movies and things like that. Yeah, Rachel and I are big fans of Ray Bradbury, who I think has written great stories across all those genres we've talked about. He's done science fiction, he's done fantasy. Probably some of his stuff is lighter on fantasy, but I think that his golden, it's sort of a golden age science fiction. He wrote some really good horror stories, though. Yeah. One that springs to mind is The Small Assassin.
Are you familiar with this?
No, I have not.
It's a story about a woman who's convinced her baby tried to kill her during childbirth and is still trying to finish the job.
I have a secret compulsion that I always want to read that story to, like, new mothers when they're pregnant. And it's, like, so awful. I'm like, no, don't do it. Don't do it.
That is marvelous.
It's like hilarious. It's like a secret, like, weird side and dark side of me. Sorry, guys.
That's fine. So Bradbury's...
It's okay. Pregnant women are smug.
He's not kidding.
Just kidding. Absolutely.
Rachel's just started watching Twin Peaks. That's its own
the
podcast.
The tree
pie
is
really
fabulous.
It's a damn fine cup of coffee.
Yes.
Lay all the donuts out. Next time we do the podcast, I just want to have donuts laid out for all of you in nice
layers,
linear rows. Yes, yeah, so the Twilight Zone was huge for me growing up. Like, that's probably another one of the bigger influences you can think of. And The Outer Limits, which...
I was just going to say Outer Limits.
Outer Limits was always, like, more... I think it appealed to me more because Outer Limits could always be relied upon to produce a creature.
And I love Tales from the Dark Side with personal fate.
I'm so jealous of you guys right now because those are shows that I would love to have watched.
It's not too late. It's on YouTube.
No, I mean, like, growing up, that would have been fantastic because the closest thing I got to that was Star Trek in The Next Generation.
Which, great in its own way, but I know what you mean. Like, and... The problem with a lot of those shows, like, Rachel, you mentioned Tales from the Dark Side, and there was also, growing up, there was Monsters, which is another anthology show.
Yes.
Produced by the same guys.
I loved all that
stuff. But they always played so late. So it'd be Saturday night, we'd be doing our best to stay awake. It's like, I'm going to sneak this cup of coffee so I can watch Monsters.
Speak for yourself. I was terrified from the opening, so I was wide awake, like, watching it.
But, I mean, to get to that point, because it usually came on, like, 11 o'clock or something. Once it was on,
oh my goodness,
it was fine. It's
yeah.
like making it. Back in the day, they're Friday the 13th, not the movies, but the TV series. Friday the 13th, the TV series. So I was always really into that sort of thing. But it was, like you said, it was kind of like it was back and forth. Like, I was kind of terrified, but I kind of liked it.
Yeah.
So I kind of kept going. So it was like, knew there was going to be sleepless nights sometimes.
Yeah.
But it was worth it.
It was worth it. So, Chris, we've been talking about horror a little bit, and you have a box.
I do. And speaking of whether or not it's worth it.
Chris, Pandora over here.
Yes.
Pandora has a box. Well, why don't you explain what that box is and what it's related to?
Well, I'm kind of a sucker for these sorts of things. I love a good subscription box. Today, we have a plethora of great choices. I used to subscribe to Loot Crate. A subscription box being like something that you pay for monthly, and you get a box full of random things that you're interested in.
Kind of grab bag mentality.
Exactly.
Right?
Like
for those people who are just like, hey, give me some
my
variety.
Grab bags always had like peanuts and erasers in it.
You know, that's not a bad description.
I always
look
for the creepy crawlers. That was my kind of deal.
But like Loot Crate used to be four or five like nerdy things, usually a t-shirt or something inside, you know.
My son has been the recipient of some of the Loot Crate stuff you bought
that's
over.
That's right.
He always
yeah,
really
a couple
enjoy
of cool
that,
little
so.
Items here and there that
this
I thought he liked.
A little mechanical spider.
This, I don't think we're going to give any of these to Johnny, but I've been looking forward to getting this box all month because I tried just for a month to check it out. There's a service called Horror Pack, all one word. And it's basically they'll ship you four DVDs or Blu-rays, depending on which option you pick, per month for like $20-$25, something like that. So, realizing that there are four movies in this box and I spend about $20-something dollars on it, it's probably a good indicator there may not be some quality materials
in
here.
I bet you my childhood's in that box.
But,
I'm just kidding.
Like Pandora's box, I cannot turn away. I have to open this thing. I've been holding on to it all day. I've been waiting for this moment. So
you showed remarkable restraint. Let me also ask, let's just throw it out there. Will it be better than the William Shatner Movie Club?
That was a dark day in my history. I think that one was crazy because that was like $50 or something, and it lasted for a year. The subscription.
Didn't
it was like
Shatner
one time,
like annul it or something once he realized his name was on the guys.
They would send you two DVDs a month, but they weren't in like DVD cases. They were in like little cardboard squares.
It was pretty chintzy, and they weren't good DVDs at all.
Well, the first one I got was Ginger Snaps, and I liked
that
Ginger
was to lure
Snaps.
You
that
in, my friend.
Good. And then everything after that was pure crap.
They were all Canadian. That was the only thing they shared in common with William Shatner.
I think there was some real stinkers in there, but I remember there was one called Falcon Down, and they sent in its own little like square.
Wasn't Shatner in it?
And it was like there was a little letter and said William Shatner was very proud of his performance in this movie. He wants to share this with all of you. And we pop it in. William Shatner's in for like 2 minutes. You know, like
he was proud that he got a full paycheck.
Yeah,
for
that small amount. It was amazing. But like I said, I can't. It's like I just can't turn away from these things.
Let's see what happens.
So I'm gonna rip this open here. Let's see what kind of gems we have.
This is live podcast.
Okay, and also, yes, if you look online, you may find a discount code. I got this for $3 off. Reach in for the first one. Hansel and Gretel. Looks like a terrible movie.
I think that's on Netflix, my friend. But isn't Sherilyn Fenn in that movie? Sherilyn Fenn from
Twin Peaks.
Oh, maybe she was in the Hansel and Gretel half-baked one.
Would have been better than this.
I don't know. But one of these, now this month they said one of these DVD Blu-rays is going to be a limited edition signed by the director. So we'll see what it is. Oh, well, this isn't bad. This is The Thing remake.
Oh,
this
actually,
was not a bad movie.
That's a higher quality than I
Yeah, that's a little higher quality than I thought
it would
be.
You have not seen
I've not seen the remake. I saw the Kurt Russell
now,
one.
I love the Kurt Russell
movie.
Yeah,
I like that one.
This
too.
I liked. It was not my favorite.
This is just totally innocent.
I was expecting
innocent.
Like Human Centipede to roll out of that thing, so this is a little bit better.
This is a not a bad one at all.
Well, he's not done. He's got, one or two more.
I'm just saying thus far.
I have no idea what this is.
Let me see.
Filmed by Elias, called Gut.
Oh my goodness!
I have no idea what that is.
Oh my gosh! I thought it was like a weird like samurai. You know how like the old like samurai movies would always have like gory covers.
Have
now
you ever
that's
heard of
just
that
jacked up looking.
Well, Fangoria says it's to be sought out, savored, and shivered to. So
it's probably terrible.
Not a sword. It's a scalpel. Ugh.
Yeah, it's a scalpel with women jammed on it.
Yeah, probably not going to watch.
The winner of the best feature at the New York Horror Film Festival.
This is
the horror pack limited edition. This might be the one that is signed.
Yeah, it is signed right there.
Oh, there he is right there. He even seemed to chew on the package for you.
It's nice.
Let me read the description here.
This one I love.
Oh, you got the Hellraiser double feature. Did you have that already?
I do not on Blu-ray. Hellraiser and Hellraiser 2 Hellbound, which are two of my favorite movies, even though they're Hellraiser 2.
It falls into the category of horror I hate, but movies I liked.
You like the Hellraiser movies?
They terrified me when I was a kid.
That's what I like about them. They're
when I watch them as an adult, I think it was I think the nostalgia won over
the whole. There was.
I feel they're very comic booky kind of in a way.
They're pure nonsense. There's true of Phantasm movies too. We were talking about. Like, I don't mean that in a bad way, but they're like nonsense in the same way that Alice in Wonderland is nonsense. Like,
kind of.
They run around worlds that don't have any. They're very dreamlike.
Ew, Pinhead. Ew, you're so weird.
Doug Bradley Pinhead. That was but you have to admit, that was a fantastic bit of costuming that Pinhead
it was.
Designed.
Yeah. So this had free shipping and it was like $21.99 with the coupon code. So I'd say actually you got a couple decent DVDs out of it.
Do it again. You don't have any of these?
I think just this one, The Thing. So if one of you guys want it, or we can give it off
it
as
looks
a prize.
Like two,
well, that's not a bad idea if you're willing
like
to do it.
It's two good ones, something that looks suspect. And whatever the H that sign thing is,
let me read
that's
this.
Not
let me read this. Gut is the name of this movie.
Well, yeah, everyone's gouged through the gut on
something,
the front.
Something is missing in Tom's life. Every day he goes through the motions. His best friend Dan thinks he has a solution, a mysterious video he's got to see to believe. I've seen this movie. A couple years ago, this guy sent me this movie, and I watched
really?
It. Like,
and you
like
watched
a feature,
a screener?
His screener, just so a digital they're... screener. Well, no, because when he sent it to me, I did not see this. He just had a movie called Gut, and honestly, as it started, it's very low budget. So when it started, it seemed pretty tame, and I was watching it, and it's not as gruesome as all this. I'll leave this for you to discover, Chris. I'm not going to provide a review right now. I will say that this is not...
The cover is not an accurate depiction.
The cover is not an indication.
No, not exactly. It's not quite as...
Looks like a real turd from here.
you know, And I actually declined in reviewing it. When you get someone who's a brand new filmmaker, I don't really want to, like, rag on their stuff. So I just respectfully declined to review.
Oh, you want to give out the thing to somebody?
Yeah, we can maybe do... No. Wait, this is for listeners, if we have any. Well, I'm being very optimistic. We have a whole base of fans already, and it's only been, what, 30, 40 minutes in. But yeah, maybe for the next podcast, because something I'm looking forward to, and actually, though, you know, I'd like to sit down and maybe watch this. I saw it with my wife, Jen, at the screening a few years ago in, like, 2011 when it came out.
Folks, listen up. You may be able to get a copy of the thing that Nathan himself has watched. That makes the value go up.
Well, that's the one you have. I will not open this one. But the thing, the original, but I say the original, and really that's a Howard Hawks version.
Yeah, exactly. It's, that movies, was a
which
remake,
is a fun
yeah.
movie, too. But the John Carpenter, the thing, which is much closer to the short story, the Who Goes There, at the Senator Theater, which is here in Baltimore, which is an old school movie house from like the 1930s, is showing on their big screen the thing in November. So Chris and
Fantastic.
I already got tickets for it.
I've never had a chance to see that in the theater, so...
I love the original, so I would watch this.
It's gruesome, but seeing the first movie, it's creature gruesome.
The first movie, the creature gruesome in that was through the roof, and that was fantastic, because I love the practical effects in that.
Carpenter was a really interesting filmmaker, because he never felt the need, I think, to... He only went over the top in some areas. I remember a good quote he had once. He said he made Halloween and did not have explicit violence, but... The Thing had an explicit monster, which I think is a good way to put it.
That's an excellent way to put it.
It doesn't necessarily have explicit violence.
You don't
it has
see
an explicit
it killing
monster.
Or murdering anyone.
It's just the nature of the shapeshifter. He looks like a busted Pop-Tart or a Hot Pocket every time he transforms. And
hey,
he looked...
The tagline, it's not human yet.
Yes, yes. So if for some reason you've never seen The Thing, I would recommend highly the original version. I wasn't a huge fan of that, but it's not a terrible movie, no.
I would say that was a decent horror pack.
Not bad for
I definitely
hours
thought
total.
It was going to be something out of like...
Well, Hansel and Gretel, I thought all the movies were going to be like that.
I thought my memories from our dad working at Dollar Video and the B horror
this
movie shelf
of our past,
was
by
going
the way, the
to
video, sort of...
roll out of that box. I thought it was going to be like, I was going to be like, oh yeah, I watched that when I was 3. Oh yeah. No.
You've gotten worse things.
Yes.
I'd say to
absolutely.
Some extent.
I don't know. Maybe I'll try it again another time.
Yeah, that's cool. And we're going to have, Chris and I, we're going to do a follow-up podcast soon. It's going to be basically just mostly related to horror stuff. We're going to have a review of The Blair Witch and stuff like that. So we're going to talk about a few more things like that. But that's cool. You'll have to keep us posted for things like that. Because that kind of stuff falls outside my radar a lot, like the pack things, like the monthly sort of...
Now I want to go see what I can find.
I think you can go down quite a rabbit
there
hole with
that,
I
imagine.
There
is all kinds, anything you want that you could find like a pack for, or a box.
Ray Bradbury pack?
Probably. I know they have ones for book clubs for people who love to read.
Cool.
So.
Yeah, we're going to be hitting the book club thing too. There's another episodes we'll be doing is specifically book related. So
cool.
Coming up next on Phantom Galaxy, we take a look back at the 1968 classic, The Planet of the Apes with Charlton Heston, a film that began an entire franchise of talking simians. Near the end of this past summer, Rachel, Chris, and myself went to a theater here in Baltimore to catch a revival of The Planet of the Apes. It was a movie that both Chris and I had seen before, but Rachel was seeing for the very first time. And for all of us, the first time we had seen this movie in the theater. What follows is our discussion recorded shortly after that screening. I hope you all enjoy it.
It's a madhouse! A madhouse!
Charlton Heston discovers a world turned upside down. The world he finds out in the galaxy will challenge every idea you've ever had of civilization. A planet where the superior beings are apes. They build the cities, make the laws, the gods, and control the guns that hunt a race of...
We went a few weeks ago to see it at the Senator Theater here in Baltimore. And beforehand, we went over to the burger place that's attached right next to the Senator now, called Clark Burger, which I was not familiar with. They've only put it in, I think, a few months ago, probably back in the winter, possibly, or the spring. And Clark Burger is kind of like a Canadian burger joint. I thought they sell hamburgers, but they also do poutine, which I've heard of, but was not really familiar with.
Well, I will say this. I was really anticipating the poutine because it's like the holy grail of snack foods for fat people. French fries, gravy, and cheese. Now, apparently, one thing I didn't know is it's got to be squeaky cheese to be...
It's authentic. Cheese curds, yeah.
It's like cheese curds, yeah, and I don't know where the squeaky part comes in. The they put all this stuff together, put it in a trough, and serve it to you. And it's pretty
delicious. Little paper trough. Mm. Little paper trough, of, like, you know, you're at the fair or something, they get the big pile of fries. And they have lots of different kinds. So they have... The basics, I think, are always the same, but you get the fries and the cheese curds, and then probably the gravy, and then they pile other things on it.
Crazy different stuff like pulled pork and things like that. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, so we all kind of just got I think we got a basic burger and then get the side, if you
get
go.
The side
of poutine, which is like, you know, a couple of bucks. They've got the larger ones, but I can't even imagine what that's like.
The side was huge.
Plenty. So that, and their burgers are good. They're thin burgers. They're more like, I'd say, thin, sort of in the same way that like a Five Guys or something is thin. But I vastly prefer, not as the bun was awesome. Now, it had a very kind of soft, almost like sweet flavor to the bun a little bit.
Unless you're really, really ready for a challenge. I was a foolish man. I went to the challenge. I couldn't help myself. I had to do the double patty. And that's just way too much. For a large guy.
If you're doing the fries, like, too. If you're not doing the fries, you'd probably be okay.
You know, yeah, probably. Yeah. But altogether, that's an awful lot. But it was good.
The cool thing about it, I think, is that the Clark Burger, actually, if you go to the center, which again, inside is like an old school movie house. You've got the really nice ornate lobby, and they've got other they've added over the past few years a few other theaters. It's on the historic registry's list of protected places, the main theater, the big theater, which is the one that they had when the building was originally there, and that's the best theater obviously in the place to see a movie.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where we saw Planet of the Apes. But in the back, I've noticed when you walk into the theater, they've outfitted some of the seats with little tables, so they will actually, Clark Burger will deliver your food to the theater. And the Senator has been doing a series of movie revivals. A few weeks ago, I came to know it because Nathan Bell told me about Big Trouble in Little China. We went out and saw that, which was really cool. That had a really weird crowd where everybody was reciting the lines. I don't think in 1986 when John Carpenter made this movie, he probably expected it to be the cult hit that it eventually became. But that was a lot of fun. Planet of the Apes audience was a little more subdued, I feel like. If you're ever in Baltimore, Clark Burger, Center Theater, you won't regret it.
No, yeah, great night.
Absolutely. So let's talk the movie. And really, I mean, we can get our general thoughts. There's no real reason to, I think, do a general review because, you know, 1968, this movie is far older than any of us
and
here.
And if there are any spoilers for anybody, I'm sorry. This is an old movie.
That's very fair. If you haven't seen it, go out and see it. Obviously, you can get it on DVD. But it was very cool, I think, just to see. It's really nice to go back and see some of these older movies on the big screen. A few years ago, I got a chance to do Fritz Lang's Metropolis on the big screen like that, and that was a neat sort of experience. Back when Blade Runner came back out in like 2008, it was cool to see that movie. What's interesting, I think, about seeing Planet of the Apes is the theater in which we saw it was probably very similar. If in 1968 you were looking for a really big, nice theater to see it in, a place like the Senator would have been the place. So I think we got that kind of that full experience. So before we go into it, because I really want to talk about is the influence of this movie. So what did you guys, I know all of us, I think, had seen it before, except for Rachel. Rachel, correct. This was your first time.
So this was my first time. I haven't even really seen any of the newer ones. This was my first time seeing the movie, and so it was kind of cool that I got to go see it at the Senator. The only memory, the only like real thing that I remember Charlton Heston from is Ben-Hur, and he plays a very different character in this. Much cooler, I think, guy. And I say cooler meaning like in...
aloof. Sort of,
yeah, in personality and in sentiment. You know, I confess that I had like that initial reaction where, you know, you see the makeup and the masks and stuff. You kind of see some of the creases and all there. And I had to, early on in the movie, say I got to get past the lack of scientific detail.
And sophistication.
The lack of, yeah, it's a little bit, and the lack of CGI. But once I got past that in my head, just got into the story, that's when I started really, like, focusing on the themes. It was an enjoyable watch. It gave me a lot to think about, and you're right, it was a lot of it was relevant still today.
Yeah, I think it was cool to have you there seeing it, like, for the first time, because I think for a lot of us, like, mm-hmm. a lot of the images yes. are iconic. It's not a surprise to say that this movie is, you know, it has a twist ending, if you will, but almost everybody knows the twist ending these days when the movies mm-hmm. were released on DVD and Blu-ray and stuff. The cover has the twist ending right saying, there. The painting and the poster.
Even I knew the twist yeah. ending.
I think what's cool is I feel like the ending still works even when the twist is spoiled, which is different than, you know, like the M. Night Shyamalan effect where the twist is the whole movie. I feel like after four sequels, we had a TV show, we had an animated TV show. I feel like after four sequels and two TV shows and two sets of remakes, that it's hard to really, like, come to this movie fresh. Mm-hmm. But in seeing it, for me, I felt like it was cool to go back, and even though I know the story, it was neat to see all the work that was put into it. In such a way that I don't think we... Because of the nature of the way movies are made now, if you look at the Apes movies, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, certainly, like Rachel said, you were talking about how, like, a lot of the costuming and stuff, when you're watching it originally, it's sort of like, we've seen so much. I mean, John Chambers' ape makeup at the time was, like, groundbreaking, and yeah. it actually went on, like...
We've seen it so much, but at the time, they had never seen anything like it.
Right, in 1968, you know. It comes out the same year as 2001, and in that time, that's around the time when... Science fiction was kind of reserved to things like bug-eyed monster movies, like the Atomic Age stuff, movies like Them,
The Fly,
and It, The Terror from Space, and things like that. Yeah, movies that were more centered around monsters and makeup effects, but a lot of it was all, it was kind of driven by either jump scares or kind of like cod science. It didn't have a lot of thought to it, I don't think. So... Mm-hmm. In 1968, the tables kind of begin to turn because you have 2001, which is a very different movie than Planet of the Apes. Mm-hmm. But they're both, in a sense, serious attempts at science fiction. Yes, there are ape costumes in the movie, but the movie isn't about, you know, apes chasing people around on a planet. Well, not all of the movie is about apes chasing people around on a planet. So I think that when you're watching this, you're coming to a real science fiction movie that sort of the themes and everything transcend the fact that the ape makeup doesn't look as good as it probably did in 1968. Now, if you go and buy a talking Wookiee mask from the store, it's got about the same, you know, visual integrity, I guess.
Or but better.
Or better. John Chambers didn't win an award for this. It was actually the first makeup award, and at the time, it wasn't actually like a category where you had several choices. They gave him a special honorary award, and it's funny because I think it was something that they were lobbying for, and they got it just as the Academy Awards, as the Oscars were happening, and they brought out Walter Matthau and a chimpanzee in a tux. to accept the award. And I just have to wonder what Walter Matthau was thinking when the chimp came out with him. It was interesting to see the makeup. For me, the thing that I noticed that I just didn't think of a lot, it's been several years since I've seen Planet of the Apes. I have them on Blu-ray, but I went back and watched the original. And I need to go back and see the rest. Charlton Heston's character, Colonel Taylor, he's not your typical Chuck Heston hero, like Rachel said. I mean, you've got him in big biblical epics like Ben-Hur and the Ten Commandments, and he did El Cid and lots of movies like that. And that was earlier in his career, the big heroic kind of The Robe, mm-hmm. these biblical movies. And then Planet of the Apes is really kind of the catalyst for his sci-fi phase. He did Planet of the Apes, he did Soylent Green and The Omega Man, which are all very dark, kind of pessimistic takes on the future. It's kind of like a start of a different phase of his career. And I thought it was really fascinating to see the kind of big blowhard Heston. You know, we think of him as the NRA guy in his later years and things like that. And to see him in this movie where he's really deriding a lot of what we think of as if you want to get pointed about it, deriding of sort of American conservative values in a lot of ways. I mean, that's not the only theme in the movie, but that's there.
It's most, like, narcissistic, I think.
He was, and...
He kind of has these sentimental underlying values, but then he comes across very cold and selfish and throughout most of the movie. But, like, he has that one line when he first lands, and he's like, talking about, you know, Earth as he left it, he goes and he says, "You who starve your neighbors," You know, as if that's like something that he cares about.
Do you make war on your brothers?
Yeah, and starve your neighbor or whatever. And he, so he's waxing on like that, but then his behavior kind of throughout the rest of it is just like kind of cold and selfish.
And that's like his whole mentality, because he'll even talk about, you know, how he kind of despises humanity,
mm-hmm.
like to a certain extent. So it's very weird that he starts off this way, and as the movie goes along, you're like, well, this guy's not really that. Doesn't really care about humanity that much.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
and I think that's one of the interesting perceived like contradictions when you watch the whole movie, is that element of Taylor being a guy who, he's really misanthropic. Like, he mm-hmm. doesn't,
very.
He's given up on humanity pretty much completely. So he comes to a world that where humanity's been reduced to animals.
Mm-hmm.
And animals have all the same foibles and problems that humans do. So the way they play with that character, it's interesting because when they made the film, they identified that off the bat. They said, we wanted you to feel ambivalent about him, but we also wanted you to sympathize with him, which you do. If the movie was made now, and I think this is borne out in the remakes, both sets, I do enjoy Rise of the Planet of the Apes and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I was not a fan at all of the Tim Burton movie, but a Tim Burton movie, look at that one, the Mark Wahlberg character, he is pretty much a bland heroic cipher. There's nothing.
Yeah.
There are no edges to his character.
Nope.
I don't feel like you would ever in this day and age get a Planet of the Apes movie with a character. They would either try to play him as a villain
mm-hmm.
or play him as a straightforward matinee hero.
Yep.
And I think for them to do that is maybe one of the most, for 1968, is probably one of the more like edgy things that they do. Or more daring things, I guess, that they do in the movie. Chris, going back to it, after we saw the movie, we were talking a little bit. What are your thoughts about Planet of the Apes?
Well, I think I have a little bit different take on Planet of the Apes because I never really had a lot of nostalgia for it. I think I saw it like maybe one time growing up. So it's never been to me this classic, iconic movie, really. I thought it was really interesting watching it again many, many, many years later because I missed all those details the first time through when I was a kid about, you know, this guy's character, how he really feels about humanity, and whether or not he wants to try and save anyone on this planet, you know, or even this woman Nova, who he kind of treats as personal property half of the movie. So it was really interesting rewatching it, and I can see and respect where they're coming from in terms of, like, the technical developments and all that kind of stuff. The stuff I found more interesting now, which completely went by the wayside as a kid, is some of the more philosophical stuff. When we're talking about the trial of humanity and the apes, when they're sitting there in judgment of him as this creature is unworthy to be in their presence. And this is all brought on because of their perception of their religion, which they have invented themselves many years ago, and they can't see past that to any of the proof that anyone else is looking into currently, like, oh, well, actually, maybe we weren't the first people here, or something like that. And not being able to really reconcile faith with reality, I think that's really something that relates to modern day, which I never really thought.
In a lot of ways, we're not really any further along with that conflict than we were in 1968, I think. And what I think's interesting is it seems to be that a lot of some of the actors and even the director, that trial scene you mentioned, which is in some ways structured around like kind of the Scopes Monkey trial, the one in the
mm-hmm.
the trial in the 20s, where you've got this professor who's basically you've got someone who's trying to teach evolution coming up against that conservative religious group and mm-hmm. organization. The way that courtroom scene is structured is very similar. And then we'll get into this a little bit later, there were two scenes that are in the movie actually that were actually never meant to be in the final cut. And one of those scenes was Heston's nude scene. And the other
Well, nobody really wants that, let's be honest.
Which was actually that was his first nude scene.
And this was PG, was it not?
No, this was G, my friend.
Ooh.
This was G rated.
G for Glutimus Maximus.
The second scene was the one, which I actually didn't even really notice until we watched it at the theater, was where the apes are doing the hear no, speak no, evil, see no evil.
Yes, that was crazy. It was kind of a, it really was like you're watching a scene and you're like, wow, they did that. You know?
Well, that was intended just to be a joke. Like,
yeah.
The whole scene they felt was over the top. Like, everyone, I think, thought that scene was almost too pointed. And it kind of is. You have Zero and Cornelius, who are two of the apes, who Taylor is the human that's come into their society, and they're defending him because to them, he backs up their scientific proof that they found that human beings were able to speak once. Mm-hmm. Because all the human beings that Taylor and his comrades, who are quickly lobotomized or killed and stuffed, are the people they come across are all wild primitives who can't speak and seem to just back up the idea that apes are the ruling class on the planet. And that they've been created that way by the creator. Their sovereignty or their intelligence has been sovereignly ordained.
I thought that they could have brought out a little bit more reality, which is people don't have to cast their faith aside as well as their perceived proof. You know, like what they see is here's scientific evidence. There's no reason that they can't exist. You just have to shape your model a little differently. And see things from maybe a different perspective. But they didn't really go into that too much. I thought that was kind of a missed opportunity.
I think so. And I think one of the things that's interesting is when this movie comes out, I think you would almost expect it to go a little more the other direction.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think there are still elements and echoes of that where it's still in some ways there are scenes and moments that sort of still have that underlying feel that this is a movie made by a Hollywood company that is within a nation that considers itself, I think, nominally Christian, if you will. So I think there's still some of the lines are not crossed there. But you're right in that the overall thrust of the movie does go in a vein that is not just questioning religion, obviously, but authority in general. And in fact, one of the weaker elements of the movie is the young, like, ape that's clearly like your 60s mod youth who comes in towards the end, and Heston tells him, don't trust anyone over 30. You know, like,
I love that line where he's got the kid with the beard, you know, and he's like, oh, a lot of kids my age have that where I come from. You keep at it, you know.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. That to me is probably the one element of that movie that really just doesn't fit, like, particularly by the time he shows up is when you're moving into some of the more poignant elements of the story. So then you've got this goofy, like,
it's time to 60s settle, hippie, settle down a little
hippie
bit,
kid ape. Yeah, yeah. One of the interesting lines is when Heston questions why Deus is both the protector of the faith and the chief science officer. And he actually says, question, well, how do science and faith go hand in hand? And it's interesting because I don't think that the movie is actually arguing that science and faith can't coexist, but I think that what the movie is trying to say is that if faith tries to exist and ignore scientific fact, are we really talking about faith or are we talking about something else? You know, I think that's kind of the questions it poses. I do like that Zaius is not really a villain, though, I would say. In fact, in a lot of ways, I think Taylor is closer to a villain than most of the characters in the movie. I mean, he's the only one who really...
Hey, he's the only one smoking a cigar. In the spaceship, no less.
In a spaceship, no less. Which, incidentally, was actually the last scene to be filmed in the movie, was him smoking the cigar and doing the opening monologue. So it's interesting when you get to the way things are filmed that was the last scene.
Well, an interesting element here was that Charlton Heston's idea. It was Charlton Heston's idea to have the crew have beards of the spaceship. He felt hair would continue to grow while they were in suspended animation. But if they're in suspended animation for hundreds and thousands of years or however long...
Shouldn't it just be a giant tube of hair?
Yeah, like it wouldn't be an inch or two. It would be a lot.
Yeah. And that was actually the first thing that caught me up in the movie was the... Stewart? Stewart is the female character?
Yes.
Is that her name?
Who they were supposed to repopulate the planet with, oddly enough.
Because oxygen gets into her tank, or whatever it is.
There's a crack in the glass.
She's...
A mummy.
But then all they have is just a little bit of hair. And so I was like, that was the first thing, because of them getting out and they got, like, beards, and they're supposedly, like, been, like, living in this thing. And Stewart's all, like, decrepit, and there's... That was the first thing in the movie I was like, and I know this is just because of me watching something that, like, predates me. I was just like...
Well, I think that's a good point, because he says he decides that the hair should be growing.
Hair doesn't stop growing.
Right, he should have got out of there looking like that guy on the Guinness Book of World Records, like the tangled curly fry fingers.
oh, gross.
But, like, if all of that, like, to... When you introduce something like that, and then they get out with the beard... You've opened up a can of worms. I feel like you should just ignore that, because Rachel asks, like, well, what about the bodily functions and everything? Like, and we can say that, well, it's 1968, they didn't worry about that. But 2001 does take into account a lot of those details.
It was honestly the presence of the beard that made me think that far into it. Before, I was just kind of letting all, like, it kind of loosely flow over my thoughts. But then when I was like, wait, so they grew beards? But then what about this, this, and this, and this? And I was like, okay, stop, Rachel. Just go with the story.
Yeah, I agree with that thought, because some people will say, well, you know, they're trying to be accurate. I think if you're going to do it, you either try to, even if you're wrong, go all the way and give us a full portrait of something.
Exactly.
Or don't do it at all, because I think you do tend to draw attention to yourself when you decide one detail but not the others. Like, you know,
this is more less the kids' sci-fi movie and more the hard sci-fi that would be later seeing, you know, down the road. I think at least in theme, you'd think they would pay attention to that kind of stuff a little more.
When we get to the end, we discover it's Earth. It's interesting, the novel is based off of a novel by a French author, Pierre Boulez, who also did Bridge on the River Kwai. He wrote the book that Bridge on the River Kwai is based off of, which is another really good movie if you've never seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Not science fiction, but a great movie. And in Planet of the Apes, the book, there is no, I guess I'm going to kind of go into a little bit of spoilers with this, but in Planet of the Apes, the book, there is no twist ending that reveals that it's Earth. There's a reference, I think, in the movie where he says, where are we? And he says, well, we're probably here in something system, which is kind of a reference that in the book, they land on a planet that's near in the star Betelgeuse. And when they go to the planet, it is a planet of apes that isn't Earth. And so the movie, the book is more satirical. An interesting thing about the book is that the ape society they come into is very modern. Like, it's planes and cars, and they live in apartments and everything like that. There's a structure to the ape society. But in the movie, in the book, you have all of that. There's even space shuttles and stuff. That's how ultimately the main character's name's Ulysses. He's not Taylor. So when he goes into space, At the end, the way he gets off the planet with Nova, who is nude in the book, the MPA quickly.
Why am I not surprised?
The relationship that Ulysses has with Nova in the book is a little bit more complicated. Like, he is drawn to her, but he's also kind of pities her for being this kind of primitive, almost subhuman in his eyes. He's a little like disgusted by her, whereas basically Hessen just thinks she's hot. Well, he has that line where he says, well, you're not as smart as Stuart, but you're the only game in town, or something to that effect. You're the only girl in town. But the production, I guess at the time they decided it would have been too costly to make the ape society modern, so we get a more feudal ape society.
How money changes these things so drastically.
Right. But Rod Serling, he said, well, Pierre Boulle had a great idea for a satirical story, but Serling's take was he's not that good at writing science fiction, which I kind of agree with. I think at the end of the book, they end up on another planet. They go back to Earth, actually, and when they get to Earth, it's inexplicably populated with apes too, which is just a twist to have a twist, much like Tim Burton's Abraham Lincoln at the end when he gets back to the planet Earth and there's just an ape statue like Abraham Lincoln sitting there. Sorry to spoil the Tim Burton movie, but technically Burton spoiled it first.
Yes, he did.
But what do you guys think about changing it to a more medieval feudal system? How did that play into it? Without knowing that it was done for money issues, and then making it Earth, how do you think that added or took away from the story?
The only thing I was disappointed by was that it wasn't more like Hard to Be a God. It was a ridiculously, like, oppressive, almost.
Very Russian science fiction movie, also based off a novel. Though to watch the actual movie, you wouldn't actually know it's science fiction, I think.
True, but, yeah, unless you knew a little bit about it.
I think that's a podcast that will only involve you and I talking about it. I've read the book. Of course, it was a translation of the book a long time ago. I tend to agree, I think, with Serling, who said...
You didn't read the original French?
No, I was not so good at French. French class was not a strength of mine. I think in the one of the things about the movie that is with the advanced society and everything, an audience might not have grasped or been as willing to go with that idea of the ape society being so backward in their thought. But I think that's what's interesting about the movie is it's satirizing, just as the book was, it's satirizing and casting reflections on our current society, which at the time, what's interesting is in 1968, we had not landed on the moon yet. Planet of the Apes is a year before we land on the moon, and you've got that scene where Taylor, being kind of a jerk, is laughing at the guy for planting that tiny American flag, the idea that American values and Earth values still somehow matter this far out on this rock out in space, and he's laughing maniacally, really. Mm-hmm. And
very awkward scene.
Right. But I think what's interesting is our current society at the time in 1968 had cars and space travel and planes and everything like that. And yet we were, in a lot of ways, and still are, we still have all those problems the ape society has. I think if you were to depict that, if it was a normal movie, the ape makeup and the feudal society give us like a remove. Like it allows us to accept a lot of critiques it's making about us. Because, oh, look, they're medieval apes. I think it's interesting. You know those lawgiver statues they have in the movie?
Mm-hmm.
Sammy Davis Jr. took one of those. What? Like, he didn't steal it. Wow. And they gave it to him. I think he is quoted as saying that he felt like that was the best movie he had seen about race relations. Even Zira and Cornelius don't exactly treat him like an equal. I mean, they treat him like proof. They treat him like a science experiment.
But as a thing.
They call him Bright Eyes because he seems smarter than the others. I mean, though to be fair, he doesn't treat them much differently. Yeah. Even after they help him. I mean, he smooches Zira there at the end. But she said, well, you know, I probably would like you if you weren't so damn ugly. Which is a good line. It kind of harkens back to Animal Farm when he says some apes, it seems, are more equal than others, which is that direct relation to the Animal Farm quote. There is kind of like a lot of George Orwellian elements, I think, to the story. To me, I think it still holds together as a movie. I don't think it's a great movie more for the ideas it brings up, more for the thoughts it provokes, more than the like actual production. It's what do you guys make of the whole Nova character? She's in the book. She actually becomes pregnant in the book.
Wait, you're saying Nova was supposed to be a character? Because I didn't notice that.
Yeah,
in the movie.
Right.
Well, exactly. But I think that's one of the elements that Serling and the others didn't quite know what to do with. And
she doesn't really evolve at all.
None at
in
all
the movie. And I think that was what I found irksome. Was I was like, she literally persistently stays this kind of piece of meat.
Yeah.
Like, tossed around. She doesn't evolve. She doesn't really seem to grow. She kind of has, I guess, somewhat of a connection with Taylor. But she, I mean, it's not like she learns to speak. It's not like she engages with him much. She's still just this thing, this wild thing, like, wandering around.
And I think that's the element between the book and the movie that Serling and the others, again, they didn't know really what to do with. That's not that different than a lot of female roles in movies today. I mean, you look at when Tim Burton did his movie, the Estella Warren character didn't do much else. True. I mean, and in fact, in that movie, they didn't even have the kind of commentary of she's like the token female, but she literally doesn't even speak, and Taylor seems to like that just fine. And in the book, they are forcibly mated. You know, the apes actually force them to mate, and she gets pregnant. She was pregnant in the movie at one point. That was the idea, but some studio exec decided that it was too disgusting to suggest that a normal man and a primitive woman would mate. Now, Nova does come back for the sequel, which is Beneath the Planet of the Apes. And in that movie, they do develop her character more. She can speak, but she basically becomes second fiddle to another bearded dude who falls out of the sky. That might be interesting to go and cover that movie at some point. With Nova, she was originally supposed to be, Ursula Andress was supposed to play Nova. That didn't quite work out. And then the actress who does play Nova, Linda Harrison, she was Richard Zanuck's the producer. She was his girlfriend at the time, and she's actually a former Miss Maryland. But here's the interesting thing. Harrison, when she originally came in, she tested, meaning when she went in and did the screen test, she tested for Zira, which is a very different female character. I mean, Zira is really the kind of character that you'd want to see, you know, a female character. Of course, she's under all the ape makeup, but
outside of Heston, she's the main character. I mean,
she really is. Later, when they do, two movies later, they do Escape from the Planet of the Apes, and she and Cornelius are the main characters. They basically fall into the Taylor role in the movie. Before we wrap up, guys, any last thoughts about the movie? Again, kind of a classic. I feel, to me, I don't think it's been really, in terms of the interesting elements, I don't think it's been usurped by any of the movies that followed it. Again, I like Rise and Dawn. I feel like they're more action movies. They're not as
totally
focused
different
on that.
Yeah.
That, you know, like, they're really cool to watch. The special effects and everything are amazing. I just don't feel like they're as quirky. Yeah, you don't...
There's no real main, like, interesting thoughts behind it. You're watching them, and you're really just watching, like, apes throw things around and stuff like that.
Yeah,
they're a little
some
more
cool elements.
Driven,
there are character
but,
driven.
Yeah.
You have some cool elements of seeing, like, these oppressed animals, like, gathering together and seeing things from their perspective. And my friend Barb we went to see the second one, and she was like, I didn't like that movie. It was just, like, an hour and a half of apes talking to each other. And I was like, that was the best part!
What do you think about that, before we close, what do you think about the crash scene, like, where the ship crashes? I thought that was interesting in that we don't see a crash, really.
we see this tiny little ship. There is no way, even, I don't care what time in the future we're talking about when we send some ship out to explore a distant planet, that it would be literally the size of a living room, and that's it. Like, it was the smallest thing ever. It was ridiculous.
And I think, again, that's that kind of weird thing of, like, coming before the moon landing. It's sort of like we just... But again...
It's a simple critique, because clearly they should do whatever they want to do.
The fact that 2001 is the same year, I think, is that one thing where you keep going back.
I was impressed that they were able to make a ship out of materials that would last that long in outer space.
Because it's like, what, almost close to 1,000 years,
and you
can
smoke cigars on it. And you can put your cigar in the pocket, still lit, in the pocket, zip it up, and it wouldn't burn through the coat. That was awesome.
That was me, like, thinking too much into it. But I was like, it really lasted that long?
Well, there's the scene in the movie where, like, they look at the ship and the hatch is open, and then Heston gives the order, open the hatch! And you're like, a little too late. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, everyone, that is our first episode. That's a wrap. Join us again next week on Phantom Galaxy. And we're going to try probably every month just to do a sort of revival, whether it's a book or a movie or something. I'm kind of looking forward to, just recently they released a Blu-ray, I guess anniversary for Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the 1978 movie. So the one from the 78 has Donald Sutherland, Jeff Goldblum, Leonard Nimoy.
One of Goldblum's best roles.
Yeah. Super creepy movie.
Yes.
So I think maybe that should be on the tap. And we will see you next time. So good night, everyone, and take care.
And that will conclude our very first episode of the Phantom Galaxy podcast. We hope you enjoyed tonight's cast, and we hope that you'll join us again when Phantom Galaxy returns with a brand new episode. If you wish to contact us, you can email us at phantomcasts@gmail.com. We're also available. You can find us on phantomgalaxy.podbean.com, and our episodes are also going up over at popcultureninja.podbean.com. All of the music in tonight's episode comes from Lithuanian artist Stellar Drone, whose ambient electronica creates soundscapes that are both haunting and fascinating to listen to. Stellar Drone's music is actually available for free on the internet in a couple of different places. You can find his Facebook page under Stellar Drone on Facebook, and you can also find all of his albums available on stellardrone.bandcamp.com. Until next time, this is Nathan Parabol with the Phantom Galaxy.